Hare Krishna. Thank you for coming today evening. So today will be the last part of this discussion on responsible relationships. How many of you are there for any of the first three parts? Okay, some of you are there. So in the first part, I talked about how hurt people hurt people. So when somebody is hurting us, rather than feeling resentful towards them, why is this person doing like this to me? We can try to see from their perspective how they are hurt. And that can create empathy. And second session I talked about how we need to make judgments, but we shouldn't be judgmental. Is we can't fix labels on people permanently. That impedes us in proper communication with them and prevents the deepening of the relationship. Then the third session, I talked about how amidst difficult situations, now we need to respond by choosing one of three options. Let's focus on not other people's behaviors, but our own values. I talked about tolerate, mitigate, and emigrate. Three options. So today in the last session, I'll talk about how we need to look up before we look around. That means that for all of us, we have different relationships in the world, and our most important relationship is the vertical relationship, that is the relationship with Krishna. All other relationships are horizontal relationships, and they are all important in their own way. At the same time, none of the horizontal relationships are eternal. And we all get a sense of our identity and our self-worth from our relationships. Say, for example, if our children do nicely, then we feel satisfied that I am a good parent. So our sense of identity comes from that relationship. One of the greatest fears today in the 21st century is a fear that is related with relationships. If we consider the fears, the top 10 fears that people had in the 18th century, 19th century, 20th century, 21st century. Two new fears have been added in the 21st century. One is the fear of terrorists, and the second is the fear of rejection. That we may try to form a relationship and somebody may reject me. Somebody may abandon me. So that fear is there because it's not just the fear that that particular relationship may break. The fear is also that when that relationship, some relationship doesn't work out, then we feel as if I am unworthy to be loved. Whenever some relationship doesn't work out, we feel unloved. But if a relationship, many relationships don't seem to be working out, then we start feeling that I am not only unloved, but that I am unlovable. And that feeling can be devastating. So the bhakti tradition helps us to understand that we are neither unloved nor unlovable, because Krishna always loves us. Krishna is always present in our hearts. Sarvasya chaham hrudi sanniveshto. He is present in our hearts and he is there because he cares for us. And he cares for us, and that's why he wants to guide us. Ishvara sarva bhutanam hriddeshe arjuna tishtati brahmayan sarva bhutani yantrarunani mayaya. In 1861 in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he guided the wanderings of everyone. So Krishna is closer to us than the closest person to us can ever be. Even if they hug us in the tightest of hugs, still that person can't come as close to us ever as Krishna always is. And that Krishna, he is the supreme person. So that relationship has to be the basis of our identity. That has to be our fundamental shelter. then when we have the security of that relationship with Krishna, then even if we experience some ups and downs in our horizontal relationships, we can cope with them. We can see any problem, we can see even a failure in a relationship as a bump on the road. But if a relationship has become the basis of our identity or the sole basis of our identity, then if that relationship doesn't work out, then we see it not as a bump on the road of life, but as the end of the road of life. My life itself has become meaningless. This happens many times in romantic relationships. If there is a breakup, people go into depression. Sometimes people even become suicidal. It's because they have defined themselves in terms of that relationship. So the only relationship we should define ourselves in terms of fundamentally is our relationship with Krishna. Jivera Swarupoi Krishnera Nityadas. And the more we practice bhakti and connect with Krishna, the more we'll be able to stabilize ourselves in all our relationships. So when we practice bhakti, we get that inner security, inner strength that Krishna is with me. And Yamunacharya in his Stotratna says, Bhavantameva anucharan nirantara prashantanishesha manoratantara kadahamaikantika nityakinkara praharshayishyami sanatha jivitam. So he is praying to the Lord, Bhavantam, my dear Lord, ever since evanucharan nirantara, I have started serving you continuously. What has happened? Prashantanishesha manoharathantara. The mind is like on a wild chariot, always running here, there, everywhere. But now it has become calm. Prashantanishesha. It has become very calm. Then, does that calmness mean passivity? That I don't do anything? No. He says, now also I have aspirations in my life. And what are my aspirations? Kadahamaikantika nityakinkaraha. When can I realize that, my dear Lord, I am your eternal servant? And praharshayishyami sanatha jivitam. And when can I delight in this relationship, understanding that I have such a wonderful Lord, that we are Sanat, we have a Lord, a protector, and praharshayishyami, in understanding His glories, in relishing His glories, that is the joy of our life. This, when we start practicing bhakti, what happens is our appreciation of Krishna's glories increases. And when we feel such a wonderful Lord is there in my heart, and we get security, we get serenity, we get ecstasy in that relationship with Krishna. And then when that relationship with Krishna is stable, then we don't get that agitated by ups and downs in our horizontal relationships. So the Lord, how far is Krishna from us right now? What do you think? Sorry? He's very near. He's in our hearts. He's one? One kaal distance. Yeah. Very small. So actually, you can say Krishna is just one thought away from us. Krishna is close to us, but in the sense we are far away from Him. Because we have turned away from Him. But if we just think of Him, if we just try to direct our thoughts towards Him, we can connect with Him. And as we practice bhakti yoga, our thoughts become more consistent, more focused. Then we can start feeling His presence. So this is Krishna. The whole process of Krishna consciousness is the process of connecting with Krishna through our thoughts. And thereby experiencing shelter in that relationship with Krishna. So the foundation for any responsible relationship is taking responsibility for our relationship with Krishna. Because once that relationship is stable, then other relationships can be stabilized thereafter. So any questions or comments at this point? Okay. So, the second point which I'll make on this now is that when we act in any relationship, so we practice bhakti to stabilize the vertical relationship, to get strength in that. And then the horizontal relationships when we act, there will be times when we like someone. So sometimes we just can't tolerate that person. And it is not the same person, one day we may feel, oh, such a wonderful person. Sometimes we feel such an unbearable person. So sometimes we get too caught with our emotions. And sometimes we feel, hey, I should not be feeling like this. And sometimes I'm feeling like this, why am I even in this relationship? So here, it's an important thing to understand that trying to control our emotions is nearly an impossible task. Instead, instead of trying to control how we feel, we can take control of how we act, of what we do. What is the difference between the two? That feelings are like the weather. The weather changes unpredictably. And sometimes it is hot, sometimes it is cold. Even in a hot season, even there also there is variation. Sometimes it's more hot, sometimes it's less hot. So if we start trying to control the weather, it's almost impossible. So just as the weather changes unpredictably, similarly our feelings will change unpredictably. And if we think our relationships are to be based on our feelings, then we cannot have stability in any relationship. Now, of course, every relationship is for the purpose where we want to experience love, we want to experience reciprocation, we want to experience joy. That is true. But our feelings keep going up and down. And if we are driven by our feelings, then we will be very unsteady. So instead of trying to control how we feel, we can focus on taking control of what we do. So if we start acting in a mood of loving service, whatever be the relationship we are in the relationship with Krishna, in the relationship with others, now how can I act in a mood of loving service? I feel so angry with this person, I feel so annoyed with this person, I feel so disconnected with this person, but let me try, how best can I serve in this situation? So if we start acting in a mood of service, we'll find that the connection will start getting established. So love is not just a noun, it's also a verb. And responsible relationship means rather than waiting for the emotion to come, we act in a way that the emotion will come gradually. Many times when we start doing a particular thing, gradually the emotion starts coming. Say, if a mother has a newborn child, and normally when the mother has a child, just looking at the child, feeling the child on the lap, seeing the child drinking the breast milk, that creates so much affection and joy for the mother. But suppose the mother has worked long and hard throughout the day, and then at night she's sleeping, and suddenly the baby starts crying. And the babies cry, they are like an alarm clock that goes off unpredictably. Now, suddenly, at night when the baby starts crying, at that time the mother may not feel a flood of love for the child. Initially, the emotion might just be, oh, why is she crying? Why is he crying? But then, the mother will wake up and fondle the child, caress the child, comfort the child. And as she starts doing that, gradually affection starts to build. The child also gets comforted. So, by taking control of how we act, we will get the appropriate feelings eventually. So, in relationships, most people, especially in today's world, they try to feel their way to actions. That means, if I feel like this, then I'll do like this. So I feel my way to actions. That's how most people act. Oh, I like this person, so then I'll relate with them. Otherwise, I don't care for them. So feeling our way to actions is what makes our relationship very unsteady. Because the feelings may come sometimes, they may not come sometimes. But the other way is, we act our way to feelings. We do the actions and the feelings follow. So, being responsible in relationship means we act in a mood of loving service. Even if we don't feel that right now, we act and gradually the feelings will come. And how can we act? That is where the vertical relationship comes into the picture. If we understand that I am a servant of Krishna, and every relationship is an opportunity for me to grow in, I'm not just serving this person, I'm serving Krishna through this person. So, even if this person doesn't reciprocate with me, Krishna will reciprocate. And with that mood when we function, then there can be steadiness. There can be stability in the relationship. So, acting our way to feelings, not feeling our way to actions. That is the key to responsibility. If we start waiting for the feelings to come, then we'll become irresponsible. And this applies actually in every area of life. The Nobel Prize winning author, he was asked once, do you write every day or do you write only when you get inspiration? So he said, I write only when I get inspiration. And I make sure that I get inspiration every morning at 10 o'clock. Now what happens? We say, how can you get inspiration according to a schedule? We cannot. But the idea is that if somebody starts doing the activity, writing is quite creative, it requires inspiration. But we can lay the ground for it. So just sit in front of a book, start writing, sit in front of a computer, start typing. And when someone starts doing that, we act our way to the feelings. And that way, we can cultivate a sense of responsibility. And when we do this, it's paradoxical. Actually, it's curious that when we don't look simply for pleasurable feelings, that is when we get the most pleasurable feelings eventually. That means, that initially I do something which feels good, and afterward it stops feeling good. It just starts feeling empty. It just starts feeling so pointless. You say, I want to watch movies, I want to eat this, I want to go there, I want to go there. I just want to do things which feel good. But afterward they stop feeling good. But in contrast, if we do something according to our values, even when it doesn't feel good, then by doing that, gradually the good feeling that will come will not be superficial, that will be much deeper, because we have lived in a way that is true to our values. We have connected with Krishna, we have acted in a way that is going to deepen our connection with Krishna. So that way, by acting our way to feelings, the feelings that we get are not fickle, are not ever changing, but they become very, they're not fickle and superficial, but they are steady and sublime. And that's how we can move forwards in our relationships. So any question about this till now? Okay, so yes, bro. Okay, good question. So although we read Prabhupada's books every day, we don't get the feeling about, I want to read. Generally, bhakti sanjayate bhakti. We need to, it is by associating with devotees that we get devotion. So when we read Prabhupada's books, Prabhupada is present over there. At the same time, we may not be able to perceive Prabhupada's presence over there. So just like Krishna is present in the deities, but we may not always perceive Krishna's presence over there. So it's same with Prabhupada's presence in his books also. That's why if we are reading, it is very helpful. In fact, it's also essential to try to share reading with someone else. That means if you have some other devotee friend also who likes to read, then make a plan that when you read, every day we'll share one point of what we read. Then that will itself, okay, what point should I share today? So in your reading, that will make your reading more active. And then we'll find more points. That's one thing, sharing the reading. Second is, generally reading becomes much more enriching when it is complemented with hearing. So, if we are reading a particular section of, say, the Bhagavatam, or if we are reading the Bhagavad Gita, then we can try to see if some Vaishnava whose classes we are able to connect with has given any classes on that topic. Sometimes when we are reading, we read at a race horse pace. I have to complete this canto, then I have to complete that canto, I have to complete that canto. Well, that's one way of reading. If that's what nourishes us, that's good. But sometimes we find that just reading slowly, going deep into a subject, that's what nourishes us. So, if you're spending 1 hour for sadhana, then you may decide half an hour I'll read and half an hour I'll hear on the same subject. And I'll hear from some speaker with whom I'm able to connect and who has spoken on this subject. So especially if somebody has given, if we are reading a second pastime of Krishna, say we are reading the Rudrasura Leela, and somebody has given a series of classes on Rudrasura, then hear that and then see how the pastime's appreciation increases. Especially if we have done systematic study, like there's Bhakti Shastri courses, there's Bhakti Vaibhava courses, where the purports are studied systematically, then essentially we start understanding, okay, how can I connect this with so many other things in scripture? So, absorption is a function of connection. When do we get absorbed in something? That is when, okay, we hear one point and then immediately, oh, some other point comes in the mind. Oh, this was spoken here, that is over here, that is over here, that is over here. So, no, there are some things in which you get naturally absorbed. Some people say, like architecture. As soon as they see a new building, okay, this shape is like this. I saw that shape over there. Now this is quite stable. This is attractive. This is not that attractive. Now this is an interesting design. This cycle. So what happens is they start connecting what they are seeing with many other things. And to the extent that connection happens, absorption happens. So an absorption is what brings satisfaction. Absorption is what brings stimulation. So for us, when we are reading something, how much are we able to connect what we read with other things? That is what will bring the stimulation, the satisfaction. And that can be developed by seeing how other speakers, other devotees, who are seasoned speakers and students of the Bhagavatam, of the Shastra, how they are doing it. So if we do these three things, share, study, hear along with studying, and try to deepen our connections. Okay, how is this connected with something else? How is this connected with something else? One way to develop a connection is, many times when we are reading something, our mind says, I've read this, I know this, I've heard this. So we could just turn that point around and say, okay, when was the last time I heard this? I read this point. Okay, when was the last time? What was the context over there? Oh, I heard that in that class. But in that class, if I am reading Rudrasura pastime, here the point seems to be that how Rudrasura had such a glorious death. He fought on heroically. But now when I am hearing this, here the point is about how Rudrasura was in a demon's body but still he was a devotee. So what happens is, even if you look at the point can be, the connections can be established also by looking at the context. There is content and there is context. So we feel this content is familiar. So, what same thing is coming again and again. But if we look at the content in context, okay, in what context was this verse quoted last time? Oh, it was like that. That will lead to greater connection again. If we consider Sangeet, if we consider music, music from the Vedic perspective basically has basic few ragas, Saregama Padanisa. But there is so much variety of music that can come, and that comes based on how these swaras are combined together, how these various sounds are combined together. Similar, so it's not just the content, the sound, but the context, which brings absorption. So similarly, if we can look at the points in the context, connect the content with the context, and see in what different context it is used, that's how we can deepen our absorption, and that will give the taste. Okay? Thank you. Yes, please.
Prabhu, you said hearing also improves our understanding, deepens our understanding by reading the Prabhupada. Is there any specific priorities which have been specified? Who to hear, how to hear?
Okay. Are there any priorities about whom to hear, how to hear? Actually, we have to understand that bhakti is an individual process. And because bhakti is an individual process, so as far as priorities of hearing are concerned, we have to find out what inspires us the most. In bhakti, there are principles and there are preferences. The principle is that we have to practice the process of bhakti. For example, chanting. Doing japa is the principle. Now, whether somebody sits and chants, or stands and chants, or walks and chants, somebody chants in front of the deity, somebody chants in front of Tulsi, these are all preferences. So when the preferences are treated like principles, that is when fanaticism comes in. Every one of us is an individual. So when we go in front of the altar, now some of us may feel a great connection with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Some of us may feel a great connection with Krishna. Some of us may feel a special connection with Jagannath. This is a preference, and that's individuality. So in bhakti, there is room for individuality. Not just room, bhakti is a process which actually brings out our pure spiritual individuality. So therefore, with respect to hearing, we can see what hearing nourishes us spiritually. Now sometimes some hearing may just be, we have to see that, as I said, it should nourish us spiritually. Sometimes some devotees in their classes may crack a lot of jokes, and then we may enjoy that, and that can be those classes can be stress busters. They are not spiritual nourishers. We have to be clear about that. Yes, sometimes we will be tired and we just need some relaxation from stress. That's okay, fine. But we cannot rate spiritual knowledge based on the laughter test. The classes where I laugh the most, all those speakers are the best. No. Yes, laughter is good, but we have to see whether I am being spiritually nourished. How do I know I am being spiritually nourished? At the end of a class, if the thing that stays in my memory is a joke from the class, then that is not really spiritual nourishment. It's good, we can use jokes also. We can always... life can be distressing, so humor is nice. But if that is what I am remembering, then at the end of my life, at the time of death, if I am remembering a joke, well, that will not be a joke. You know, that will be a tragedy. You want to remember Krishna at the time of death. That's why we have to see what nourishes us spiritually. That means, if we hear a particular class, we hear a particular point, and that stimulates us to remember Krishna more, that deepens our remembrance of Krishna, then we can hear that more. So with respect to whom to hear or in what order to hear, after we have been practicing bhakti for a few years, then this is something which will be a matter of individual preference. Okay? Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Yes, Prabhu.
All this material life, spiritual life, association, all those things.
to develop a vacuum kind of a thing. How do you overcome that? That we realize that you start questioning yourself, is it all okay? And a total vacuum overshadows our thoughts for some incidents which might happen, and the enthusiasm goes down. How do you overcome those kind of a situation? Come back to God.
What do you mean by a vacuum exactly?
Vacuum, like you feel numb. Some incidents might happen, some association, and then you know it shakes you a lot, and then you start thinking everything is okay or right or what to do.
Okay.
How do we regain the rejuvenation if something goes down in this part of
okay? Yeah. So in bhakti, if some unpleasant, unsavory incidents happen, say some negative interactions happen with others, and that makes us numb, and then we lose the energy to practice bhakti. So how can we regain it at that time? One principle in bhakti is that nothing and no one should be allowed to come between us and Krishna. No relationship is as important as our relationship with Krishna. And just as attachment can be a temptation, similarly, aversion can also be a temptation. Normally, temptation, we use the word in the sense that which gives us pleasure. But temptation essentially means that it distracts us from Krishna. So sometimes, if we are too attached to someone, say if we are too attached to someone, and we come to the temple, and we are not so much interested in taking darshan of the deities, we are interested in that person. So, but sometimes the same distraction can happen if we are averse to someone. If you have had a very negative interaction with someone, we are taking darshan of Krishna and we just hear that person's voice somewhere. And immediately our mind fights, what is this person here? What is he going to do? What is he going to speak about? So that aversion is also a distraction from Krishna. It's also temptation. That's why Krishna says several times in the Bhagavad Gita, Raga Dvesha Vimuktaistu. So, this point I'm making to understand, this is nothing new. This is a distraction, that is a time-tested distraction which Maya sends our way. That means just as Maya may tempt us, Maya may distract us through attachments. And so Maya may distract us even through aversion. So when that starts happening, you see that, okay, this particular devotee behaved this way, or I had this kind of nasty interaction with this person. But this is also a test of my devotion. And ultimately, my relationship with Krishna is more important than whatever interaction I may have had. So in principle, we see this not as something unprecedented or catastrophic. It is a predictable pitfall on the path of bhakti. Aversion is a predictable pitfall. When it comes, we see that as a working of Maya beyond whatever that person may have done. I gave a class in America, in Silicon Valley. The theme of the class was, focus not on the wrongdoer, focus on the ultimate doer. There will be a wrongdoer. See, when Parikshit Maharaj was cursed by Sringi, it was a disproportionately excessive curse for a small mistake. So Sringi was a wrongdoer. But throughout the Bhagavatam, we don't see any incident or any expression where Parikshit expresses anger or resentment towards Sringi. Okay, that happened. He takes shelter of Krishna. He says, focus on the ultimate doer. That how can I serve? Now my situation has changed because of this person's actions. So in this changed situation, how can I serve Krishna? So this doesn't mean that wrongdoer was right. That wrongdoer was wrong. But is it, Parikshit Maharaj did not feel it was his responsibility to correct that wrongdoer. He said, I have been cursed. If that person has done wrong, that's between them and Krishna. So for me is how best I can serve Krishna in this situation. So when we focus on the ultimate doer, when we see every situation is ultimately meant to deepen our connection with Krishna, then we can move forward steadily. And if that numbness is persisting, then we have to see within bhakti what is it that stimulates bhava for us. Rupa Goswami uses the word uddipan. Uddipan is spiritual stimulus. Just like for each one of us, there may be certain sense objects that may attract us. Say, now all of us want food. That's a necessity. But certain foods attract us. Say, if somebody is South Indian, as soon as they hear of idli sambar, dosa, maybe they get excited. Somebody is Punjabi, then parathas. Somebody is Gujarati, then maybe kakra. So, like that, food is universal. But there will be specific foods that attract us. So just as in material life, there are particular sense objects that attract us, that trigger emotion within us. Similarly, in spiritual life, for all of us, there will be particular stimuli that trigger emotion within us. So for some of us, it may be a particular darshan of the deities. Not just deities, but a particular deity and a particular darshan of the deity. When they're dressed with this color dress, oh, they look so attractive, I feel so attracted. Or it may be kirtan. Not just kirtan, but maybe a particular Hare Krishna dhun sung by a particular devotee. It may be bhajans. Oh, this bhajan, when it is sung in this way, I feel so enriched by it. So that way, when we see what is it that can stimulate us spiritually, it may be a particular devotee's classes, again, as we discussed about earlier. So then, we have to put ourselves in Krishna's gravity pull by bringing those stimuli close to us. So Krishna has a gravity pull and Maya has a gravity pull. So Maya's gravity pull takes us away from Krishna and makes us numb to Krishna. But then when we are feeling numb, we have to put ourselves in Krishna's gravity pull. How? Krishna, when we put ourselves in Krishna's gravity pull, it will attract us towards Him. But how do we put ourselves there? By exposing our consciousness to the particular uddipan that stimulates us. So by that, the numbness can be overcome. Okay? Thank you. So any other questions? Okay, so I'll make one last point and then if there are any other questions, we can discuss that. So ultimately, when we are talking about responsible relationships, there is in responsibility, there are two aspects to it. There is when to take control and when to let go of control. Responsibility is in both senses. That, so I say, when a child is small, the parent's responsibility is to guide, protect, take care of the child. When the parent grows up, at that time, the parents need to provide the child wings to fly. The parents need to let go of the child. If a 25-year-old child, the parents try to control that child the way a 5-year-old child is being controlled, not only will the child be choked, but the child will not be able to grow. The child will not only be unhappy, but will also not be able to mature. So in every relationship, there is taking control, and there is ceding control. There is letting go of things. So sometimes when we are in a particular relationship, we expect the other person, they should be like this. But when they are not like that, we may try to persuade them, we may try to explain things to them. But if that is not working, then we need to let go. Let go doesn't mean that we let go of the relationship itself. It just means that that particular aspect may just not be changeable. And that it requires strength to let go. Normally we think of it requires strength to hold on. That is true. But it also requires strength to let go. Because when we let go, we are actually also letting go of our attachment. So there is a difference between responsibility and attachment. That's the point which I conclude. See, attachment means that we hold on to that relationship, that object, that person, whatever be the cost. So, for example, Dhritarashtra was attached to Duryodhana. That what happened in that case? That whatever Duryodhana did, Dhritarashtra couldn't say no because he was attached. So attachment in the relationship means that we just don't think of the costs in the relationship. We just act irrespective of the costs. So that is, so he could never let go of Duryodhana. And that's what created big, big problems for him. Vidur, right from his birth, of Duryodhana told him, Dhritarashtra, you will have 99 more sons. This one son, if you keep him, he will cause the destruction of your whole dynasty. Now when Vidur told Dhritarashtra, you have to give up this son, that doesn't mean he has to be irresponsible and just throw the son on the streets. He could have handed over the son to someone else. It is Duryodhan, because he got all that royal comfort, he felt entitled to that. And that made him more arrogant. That made him more insecure when that was taken away from him. That made him more envious when the Pandavas got all that. So he had some evil tendencies, but if he had not got royal power, he would not have been become that evil a person. So Dhritarashtra could not let go. Attachment means we want to continue the relationship no matter what the cost. But responsibility means that we see the relationship as a service to Krishna. And we understand that this is service to Krishna, so I will do it as well as I can. But this relationship is not my only service to Krishna. There are different ways in which I serve Krishna. So if we consider our consciousness to be like water, and the various relationships we have, they are like channels through which the water of our consciousness is meant to go towards the ocean. And that ocean is Krishna. That ocean is Krishna. So through various relationships and all the responsibilities that we undertake in those relationships, all the services that we do in those relationships, they are all meant to be channels for the water of our consciousness to reach Krishna. Now, we would like from all our relationships, from all the channels, the water to go to Krishna. But sometimes a particular channel may get blocked. Now, because the channel has got blocked, that does not mean the river should get blocked. If the channel is blocked, okay. I tried to unblock this channel, it's not already unblocked. We'll keep trying over here, but let the water move towards through the other channels. So letting go means that we, if a particular relationship is not working out, that doesn't mean we abandon it, but it just means that we don't obsess so much on it that we lose perspective. This is a service to Krishna, it's an important service to Krishna, but if this service to Krishna doesn't work out, still, there are other services I can do. Say, if we distribute books, or if we do classes, or if we do kirtans, or if we do puja, if we do cooking, each one of these is a service to Krishna. And we would like to do it as well as we can. But suppose situations change and a particular service that we are doing, you're no longer able to do that. For whatever reason. Now that doesn't mean that our relationship with Krishna has to stop. Okay, this service is not possible. There are other services I can do. So when we see a relationship as a service to Krishna, then there can be both responsibility and detachment. How? Responsibility, because it's a service to Krishna, let me do it the best that I can. But detachment, because I understand that I am not the controller. It is Krishna who is the controller. And if somehow this particular thing is not working out, this channel is blocked, then I will make sure that my other services go on, that the water of my consciousness moves towards Krishna through the other channels. And that way, we can move forward peacefully, even if there is disruption in our life. We may not be peaceful always, but we can at least be purposeful. That okay, this is not working out, This will cause some agitation, but purposefully we move towards Krishna through whatever services we can do, whatever relationships are moving forwards, we move forward. And no channel stays blocked forever. Eventually that blockage will also go away. But just because a channel is blocked, channel of our consciousness is blocked, doesn't mean our consciousness should get blocked. We can move forward steadily through the other channels. And by Krishna's plan, eventually that channel will also be unblocked. So I'll summarize. I spoke today on the topic of focus first on the vertical relationship with Krishna. Look up before we look around. I spoke 3 points. First is that our defining identity should be, our defining relationship should be our vertical relationship with Krishna, not the horizontal relationships. This is what is eternal. And if we can get strength and stability to that through that relationship, then even if there are disruptions in the horizontal relationships, we will see them as bumps on the road of life. But if the horizontal relationship itself has become our defining relationship, then a problem in that relationship will seem like the end of the road of life. So that perspective we get when we make the vertical relationship the foremost by practicing bhakti diligently. Then second point I talked about is that when we are acting in the horizontal relationships, we should rather than feeling our way to actions, we can act our way to the feelings. So if we try to control how we feel, it's a losing battle. Our feelings are like the weather, it keeps changing unpredictably. But if we feel our way, if instead we take charge of what we do. So love is not just a noun, it's also a verb. It's not just an emotion, it's also an action. So we start acting in a mood of loving service, gradually the connection will develop. And we may want good feelings, but good feelings come temporarily by just doing things which feel good. But good feelings come substantially when we live according to our principles. That connects us at a deeper level, and then the feeling that comes is not superficial and ephemeral, but it is substantial and it is spiritual. It is sublime. And last point I talked about is how responsibility means also learning when to let go. When attachment is there, then we want the relationship at all costs, and that sometimes the cost may be just too much, like it happened with Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana. So to let go means that if we are trying our best but a particular relationship is getting blocked, then we see that relationship as a service to Krishna but not as our sole service to Krishna. That is one channel through which our consciousness is meant to flow towards Krishna. If that channel gets blocked, then other channels are still open. And with that, we can, even if that relationship is blocked, we can continue serving Krishna purposefully. And by Krishna's plan, in due course, that channel will also get unblocked. And thus, we can responsibly do services in whatever relationships are working, and responsibly distance ourselves from something which doesn't seem to be working, so that we can focus on that which does work. So thank you very much. Hare Krishna. So, any questions? Balwant Roy is not here. There's one question which he had asked about in the second session about Sita being exiled. So maybe I'll answer it. Some of you can repeat that to him later. So this question is, why did Ram abandon Sita? The book on the Ramayana has come today. So it's, I think you said outside. So that's, I explain this in terms of an acronym, SEES. Now, he who has eyes sees, S-E-E-S. So first S is selflessness. There's selflessness, sacrifice, and let's look at this first. So first is, if we consider the mood of sacrifice and the mood of selflessness. These are two S, beginning and end. But if we consider, say, if it was Ram was irresponsible or attached or too reputation conscious, because of that he abandoned Sita, then he could very well have immediately married someone else. If a king is very reputation conscious, for that king to not have any queen with him, that is not a reputation and answer at all. Later on, when Ram had to perform yajnas, the Brahmanas told him, yajna has to be performed by the husband and wife together. So he said, I will not marry. He had a golden effigy of Sita made, and he had that sit with him. So now, in yajnas, only for doing yajnas, purity is required. So Ram personally considered Sita to be so pure that he would even have an effigy of Sita sit with him for performing yajna. So through both these points, that Ram did not remarry and Ram had Sita's effigy for doing yajnas, that indicates that Ram did not personally reject Sita. Ram personally respected her as his wife. So then, why did he actually abandon Sita at that time? So for a king, it is important to set an example. And what is the example in that particular context? The example was that of detachment. So generally the king has the best material things to enjoy in life. And when the king follows dharma even in that situation, that inspires others to follow dharma. If the king, despite having material things, adheres to dharma, then others are also inspired. So when this particular rumor started going in Ayodhya that Sita is not pure, Ram had two choices. One is that he could either neglect or squash that rumor. Now, if you squash that rumor, all that would happen by that is the people who were circulating that rumor, they would think, just see, he's so attached, that when we are speaking the truth, he is acting against us, abusing his royal power. That would have actually worsened the situation. He could have neglected the rumor, but rumors are dealing with them is a very complicated thing. Sometimes when a fire is lit, if a fire is like a candle, it's a candle's fire. A wind comes, the wind will extinguish the fire. But if there's a big forest fire that is lit and the wind comes, then it can spread the fire like anything. I just in America about 15 days ago, so then California, there is a big fire which has been going on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it's devastating, and the big problem comes when the wind comes. So similarly with respect to rumors, sometimes the rumor is small, just the passage of time squashes, the rumor goes away. But sometimes the rumor is like a fire, and as time passes, the rumor simply grows bigger and bigger and bigger. So how to deal with that, only the person in that situation has to decide. It's very difficult for us to judge from our perspective. So when Ram, he in that situation felt that the best way to deal with that rumor would be that he distanced himself from Sita. Now sometimes you may say that Ram banished Sita. Now banished may not be the most appropriate word for that, because banishment means, as happened to Ram himself, deep in the forest, out of the kingdom, with no shelter at all. But when Ram sent Sita away from him, he arranged for Lakshman to take her right next to the hermitage of Valmiki. And in Valmiki's hermitage was in Ram's kingdom itself. So in that sense, Sita was indirectly still in Ram's protection. So it was just that he distanced himself from her. And this he did so that people would not accuse that the king is attached and use that accusation to rationalize and aggravate their own attachments. So it was actually a greatly selfless act on his part. Ram, he himself was distressed by it. It was not that he got any joy in doing that. Then, if we move forwards, this was, as I said, the second point is what I was talking about was an ethical dilemma. There are moral dilemmas. Moral dilemma means one option is moral, the other is immoral. If somebody offers somebody a bribe, should I take it or not take it? It just requires moral strength. Don't take it. It's a temptation. But ethical dilemma means there are two courses of action and both of them are good. But which is better? There are two dharmas, both of them are important, but which is priority over here? So Ram had his dharma as his king and Ram had a dharma as a husband. So Ram at that particular point gave priority to his dharma as a king. He did not reject his dharma as a husband, but he subordinated that. And especially in a country like India where nepotism is so common. Nepotism is partiality towards, favoritism towards one's own relatives and family members. You know, one politician gets elected, then 100 people from the politician's family, they get appointed in the government and they get plush facilities because of that. So actually Ram's detachment is exemplary for in such a nepotistic culture. So Ram had an ethical dilemma and he resolved it in the best way he could in that situation. That's E. Then third E is, this. There are esoteric explanations for this. The Ramayana itself explains that long ago, there's a demon who was terrorizing the Devatas. And finally, Vishnu along with the Devatas turned the odds against this demon and the demon fled. And as the demon was fleeing and Vishnu was chasing him, the demon sought shelter with Khyati. Khyati is the wife of the sage Bhrugu. And she had a misguided sense of compassion. She said, okay, I'll protect you. And then Vishnu, he came there along with Devatas. And Vishnu told Khyati, he's a terrible demon. If you protect him, tomorrow he will destroy you. He will destroy the gods. He will break havoc in the universe, he said. He said, give him to us. He said, no, I'll not give it to him. He says, no, he's a demon. He is simply using you right now. So Vishnu talked again and again and again with her. But when she was not able to listen, and this demon would have slipped away and he would have wreaked havoc. He had already killed thousands and thousands of people. So finally, Vishnu is the Supreme Lord. And even if somebody is killed at his hands, they get liberated. So because Khyati was not ready to stop, so Vishnu uses mystic powers and silences Khyati. And then he killed this demon. And then when Bhrugu came, Bhrugu felt that Khyati has been killed by Vishnu. And he cursed Vishnu at that time. He says, just as I have been separated from my wife, you will be separated from your wife when you decide. Madhvacharya describes another story that in his he's written the Mahabharata Tatpar Nirnaya, that there is a demon who was, now these, so many demons are very cunning. They want immortality. And we know Hiranyakashipu, he asked neither inside nor outside, nor day nor night, nor human nor animal. Nobody should be able to kill me like that. So there is a demon who prayed to the Devatas, to Brahma, and he said, I should never be killed as long as Lakshmi and Narayan are united. Now Lakshmi and Narayan, he thought, will never be separated, and that way I'll never be killed. So what he did was that he asked the benediction. He thought, I'm very clever. But Lord Narayan is cleverer than everyone else. So then when he descended as Ram from this world, then in Ram and Sita, when they got separated, that was the time when Indra attacked this demon. And Indra fought against this demon, and he was a very powerful demon. And finally, Indra killed the demon. And after Indra killed the demon, that's when Ram called Sita back. Sita had been in the forest for a long time. Lav Kush had already been born. And Ram called Sita back at that time. And the last point is, first I talked about selflessness. The last point is related with that. It is sacrifice. Sometimes this story is used to talk about how, you know, Sita was, so much injustice was done, and in India women are so much exploited, abused, neglected. But actually this interpretation, it does injustice to the character of Sita. Sita is a very strong, powerful woman. And when this happened, when Sita was sent away by Ram, naturally initially she was shattered. But eventually she understood why Ram is doing this. And she accepted it. She never blamed Ram for it. So actually, this was a sacrifice which both Sita and Ram did together. And rather than seeing Ram as unfair and Ram sending Sita away, we have to see, if at all anybody is to be, if there's any comparison, the comparison between Sita and Ram is similar to the comparison earlier between, to the situation of Sita and Ram is like the situation earlier of Ram and Dasharath. When Dasharath had to exile Ram, it was not that he did it out of pleasure. He did not do it out of reputation. He did it out of obligation. He had to honor his word. And when he did that, Dasharath himself was distressed and Ram was also distressed. But Dasharath did it stoically, Ram did it stoically. So just as Dasharath and Ram had a mood of sacrifice in doing something, although it was very difficult. Similarly, Ram and Sita had that mood of sacrifice. And that is why this mood of sacrifice, which is so vital in every relationship. In every relationship, sometimes we have to do something which inspires the other, which is required for the other person, although it may not like it, it may not please us. So this, if we consider broadly speaking, India has one of the strongest family structures in the world. In the Western world, the family structures are collapsing quite a bit. So, and for India, Ramayana is probably the most defining book. The Bhagavad Gita is important, but Bhagavad Gita is always a more philosophical book. The Mahabharata is there, but Mahabharata did not influence the Indian mind as much as the Ramayana. So, if Ram were simply an irresponsible, whimsical man who abandoned his wife when she was pregnant, then how could inspiration from such a book inspire such a strong family culture and ethos within India? It is because the specifics are not to be replicated. The important thing is the principle. The specific is, did Ram suspect Sita and just sort of suspicious, small suspicion abandon her? No, that, there's a whole context to that. And that specific was Ram in a very extraordinarily difficult way, and even Sita in an extraordinarily difficult way, demonstrating the universal principle of sacrifice. And that principle of sacrifice is what we are meant to internalize. Not in the same specific way, but in the way in which is required in our situation. So that way, the Ramayana inspires us with that mood of sacrifice. And that sacrifice is what strengthens relationships. So Ram's sending Sita away is actually an act of responsibility both on the part of Ram and on the part of Sita. It's an extreme example that is never to be imitated. But the essential mood of sacrifice is extraordinary. And in our own small ways, that mood is to be internalized in our life. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki,
Jai.
Itai Gaur Premanande.
Premo.